You're back with the Indie Media Show here on RTR FM 92.1 with your hosts Zoe and Alex. Now, I did threaten at the top of the show to give an editorial on a number of interrelated matters. So, yeah, do switch off now if you don't like the sound of my voice. But no, in all seriousness, I have been toying with the idea of making this a regular feature on the show. I'm not sure what to call it at this stage. Field notes from the road to global war, updates on the poly crisis, or perhaps new developments in the long emergency. Watch this space. I may come up with a formal title in the near future. But suffice it to say, there is much that can be said on multiple fronts. And when I say fronts, I'm talking about military and political fronts. And I think a good starting point conceptually is to frame our understanding in terms of the dramatic, rapid and very likely permanent collapse of what liberal policy wonks and zombie talking head Western politicians like to call the international rules-based order. This so-called international rules-based order briefly consists of a series of interconnected multilateral institutions and agencies, the United Nations obviously being central to this network, to this matrix of organisations, but we can also include the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, which, by the way, is virtually never mentioned anymore, which is very telling, the World Bank, the International Court of Justice, sometimes colloquially referred to as the World Court, and so on. There's a number of other institutions that fit into this this lattice of multilateral agencies that govern this apparent world order. The point being that the total collapse, and at this point it really is the total collapse of even the fiction of liberal order and internationally agreed upon rules being followed in relation to trade, commerce, economic affairs generally, but most especially in relation to war, tells us about the nature of the historical period in which we're entering, which is that myth of stable liberal international rules in relation to all those fields of human affairs, which I've mentioned, has totally melted away. And so we are now not entering future tense, but entered present tense, a world much more similar to the world that our ancestors inhabited in the 19th and early 20th centuries, which is one a world governed by one principle and one principle alone, force. Whether that is politically constituted force, socially constituted, or militarily constituted. So we all know the wider backdrop of this new historical order, which is the looming war or the putative war or the road to war between the emerging second superpower in China and the waning, rapidly declining, sclerotic, chaotically governed hyperpower or previous hyperpower, superpower. The terminology is important here, by the way, as to what we call the beast. The beast, of course, being the United States of America, that entity which has caused so much suffering and bloodshed and poverty across the world and created a mountain of tens of millions of corpses in its wake as it has raped the Earth's resources and destroyed most of our brothers and sisters' capacity across the world to govern their own affairs and pursue democratic administration of their society. So as that beast becomes more and more wounded, we know that analogy, beware the wounded beast, then it will increasingly lash out in an unpredictable and chaotic and violent ways. But of course, it's not just the United States of America that we need to be concerned about. One of the things, one of the key developments we're seeing as this so-called liberal international order established in obviously the post-Second World War period and reaching its zenith, one would argue, in the post-Cold War period of the 1990s, the so-called unipolar moment of global hegemonic supremacy by the United States. We're seeing, particularly in the last few years, the emergence of other powers beyond simply China, their political, economic and military alliances recalibrating and expanding at a rapid rate of knots across the globe. And these are developments that most people, and when I say people, I'm including even social and political commentators and analysts, certainly in the Western press, developments that most people aren't noticing. One of the key ones is totally flown under the radar. You need to actually really pay attention to know that this is happening, that Saudi Arabia, Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Ethiopia and Egypt have, as of the 1st of January this year, formally joined BRICS. What is BRICS? For those of you who aren't familiar with the acronym, Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa. Now, as a brief aside, in terms of the origin of that term, it was originally coined in 2001 as BRIC, didn't include South Africa at that stage, by the Goldman Sachs economist Jim O'Neill in his report, Building Better Global Economics, Global Economics paper number 66. It was a thought bubble, a thought experiment. There wasn't any formal alliance known then as BRIC, whereas now, 23 years later, the BRICS has become a formal alliance of emerging economic powers, and sometimes called middle order powers or second order powers. And the fact that Saudi Arabia, Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Ethiopia and Egypt have joined that alliance is highly, highly significant, because it tells us a great deal about the changing nature of the political and economic alliances that govern this world. And it demonstrates and illustrates, as I say, the waning power of the United States of America in this new world in which we find ourselves, at which I've mentioned before the importance of language. And one term that we're seeing a lot of more in terms of those understandings, analyses of this new world order is multilateralism or multipolarity. So increasingly, people who pay attention to this stuff, geopolitical analysts, are saying that we've entered a multipolar moment where we have obviously China as the principal emerging global superpower in competition with the United States of America, with key allies in Russia and potentially India as well, and potentially these Middle Eastern countries. I mean, Ethiopia is not a particularly important economy, neither is Egypt, but it's the fact that some of these Middle Eastern countries have joined BRICS is highly significant in the context of the Middle Eastern region, which, speaking of the Middle Eastern region, I'll come on to that briefly in terms of the latest developments here, and hopefully everything I've just said will give you a better contextual understanding of why not only what is happening in the Middle East presently is so important, but also why it's so extraordinarily dangerous, because it connects very directly with a number of other global developments that have seen this total freefall in international order and seen humanity. Sometimes I feel like I'm being a little bit hyperbolic and melodramatic with my commentary, but I'm being deadly serious about everything I'm saying. It means that for all of humanity, we're now seemingly on an untrammeled road to total catastrophe and total war. But zooming back into the Middle Eastern theatre, we've seen a third wave of attacks on Yemen by the United States and Britain, targeting 13 locations and 36 different munitions dumps and weapon silos, reportedly storage facilities for the missiles used by Ansar Allah, as well as radar installations and anti-aircraft systems. These bombings have been supported diplomatically by Australia, Bahrain, Canada, Denmark, the Netherlands and New Zealand. I'm going to repeat that list of countries: Australia, Bahrain, Canada, Denmark, the Netherlands and New Zealand. The reason I repeated that list is because it's a very strange kind of eclectic mix that for those listeners who are old enough to remember, the kind of alliances that United States could mobilize and call upon in the past. It's kind of there's an element of absurdity to it, and there's a kind of a ridiculous flavour to that list of countries, and it very much speaks to a kind of cobbled together coalition that's the best America could do. Basically, you'll notice some of the countries missing on that list: Germany, France, Italy. Some of the major European powers are missing because they want nothing to do with this insanity of bombing the poorest country in the Arab world and one of the poorest countries in the entire world, killing peasants and farmers who you can argue over the morality of what they are doing. The first thing to say is that one could at least make a strong legal argument that it's internationally protected, trying to prevent commercial shipping going through the Bab al-Mandeb Straits in the Red Sea, because there's a sort of a broad legal principle. If you conduct something that may be seen prima facie as criminal in order to prevent a greater crime, there is a legal precedent to say that the first crime that's been committed is ipso facto but rendered null and void as a crime because it's been prosecuted in an effort to avoid the greater crime. But broadly, in the wider region, again, speaks to the tensions that are taking place that I've spoken about. We've seen bombings of Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps positions in Syria, Qatab Hezbollah in Iraq, following the death of three American soldiers on the Jordanian-Syrian border. We don't know exactly who was responsible for the killing of those soldiers, but it would seem most likely the Qatab Hezbollah militia in Iraq. They've actually conducted 150 attacks on US forces, and they, depending on your point of view, got lucky this time, or the American soldiers got unlucky. One report suggested that that American field-based, some dispute, by the way, as to whether it was within the territory of Jordan or Syria over the border. Either way, some reports suggest the American stationed at that base incorrectly thought the drone coming in was one of their own surveillance drones, and so they didn't employ their anti-aircraft systems. They let the drone come in above the base. It dropped its munitions and killed those three American soldiers. Of course, meanwhile, clashes continue between Hezbollah and the Israeli army on the Lebanese-Israeli border, and goes without saying, really, the centerpiece of all of these connected developments is the ongoing genocide committed by Israel in Gaza, which has become the furnace, the central engine of all of these sorts of developments now taking place, not just throughout the Middle East, but throughout the world. And specifically in terms of developments on the ground in Gaza, it's reported that 30 people were massacred in central Gaza in one of the ostensible safe zones in the coastal strip. And I'll just wrap up in terms of our own government's position on what's happening in Gaza. We've already mentioned that the Albanese government has signed up to this lunatic attack on the people of Yemen, which, even viewed from the perspective of the United States of America, is only going to serve to destabilize the region and actually provoke the enemies of the United States and the supporters of the Palestinians to increase their own efforts to resist what Israel is doing. So they're not going to sort of pacify and stabilise the region. It's going to have the opposite effect, and Albanese sees fit to support this destabilisation effort, quite apart from the moral questions as to whether those attacks should be supported. But also, most disgracefully, I think, in recent days, in terms of Australia's role in everything I've spoken about, most disgracefully, Australia is one of the countries that agreed to suspend funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. The amount of money that's now been deprived to UNRWA is around $440 million, which some estimates suggest that's up to half of UNRWA's current budget has now been denied the agency. You've got to understand the context of that, and that's a crime. It's gross moral turpitude. It may be the thing that Albanese is remembered for in posterity in 50 years' time in history books, that Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister of Australia, decided to suspend humanitarian aid funding to 2 million people when there are Palestinians in Gaza eating grass and drinking poison water, and hundreds of thousands of people are now not only desperately hungry, but are in fact facing famine. Shame on you, Anthony Albanese, that you are contributing to the starvation of 2 million people. And anyone who thinks, I used the word hyperbolic before, if anyone who thinks I'm being hyperbolic in making that commentary, you want to do your research, and more generally, you want to take this overall situation more seriously. There's a reason why we quote-unquote obsess over Palestine on this show, because once you understand Palestine, then you will understand the world. And developments that are now taking place in the world, I get some people say, I'm apolitical, I want to just play music, I need to go to work, I have study to do, etc. That's all fine. People need to get on with their lives, but you need to pay attention. If you're a human being, you need to pay attention to everything I've talked about, because whether you like it or not, and whether you think of yourself as a political person or not, let me guarantee you, it will be affecting your life directly, one way or another, sooner rather than later. Anyway, those are my comments for today, and I hope you've gained something from them. We're coming to the final minutes of the Indie Media Show. Thanks so much for joining us today, and thanks to Zoe so much for co-hosting. Any final thoughts, Zoe?
No, thank you so much, Alex. It's been a fun educational experience to sit here in awe.
Goodness me, too much. But no, do stay tuned, of course, Out to Lunch coming up next here on Archer FM 92.1, The Sound Alternative. Rhian Todd Hunter is going to be your host, so do stick around. We're going to go out to a bit of a track here from Idols. The track is Grace. And of course, as we say every week, don't hate the media.
Become the media.
See you next week.